This week, The Lunch Podcast talks with Allison Wilmore, newly hired film critic for BuzzFeed and veteran of IFC.com and Film Spotting SVU. Remember, The Lunch is brought to you by Snoot Films, maker of fine quality entertainments like Cheap Thrills and the upcoming The Guest. Rocky, and you're listening to The Lunch, a podcast about film and, food, where every week I talk to a creator or a critic over a midday meal, and then, after that meal, talk with them for this podcast about the issues of the day and a little bit about where we ate. This week it's very much my pleasure to have as my guest Ms. Allison Wilmore. While many of you know Ms. Wilmore's work from IFC.com or IndieWire, or as a co-host of the Film Spotting SVU streaming video unit podcast, she's also newly hired as the film critic for BuzzFeed.com. In fact, the first hire at BuzzFeed with the word critic in the title. Allison, thank you very kindly for joining us, and welcome to Los Angeles.
It's my pleasure to be here and to be talking to you.
So, newly hired at BuzzFeed to be their film critic, there's a bunch of listicle jokes one could make, or cat video jokes one could make.
I've heard them all already.
I'm sure you have, but the other thing is that those jokes aren't funny, because you've flat out been hired to cover the world of film. Can you talk a little bit about the ambit you've gotten from your editors?
Well, it's certainly going to be a role that's evolving as it goes along, but I was hired to write criticism. And, BuzzFeed has invested a lot in journalists who cover serious topics, in longer form writing, as well as the lists that have made the site so high trafficked. But, part of my mandate has been to think about how film criticism is evolving and how to make it more reader-friendly while also covering films in an intelligent way and doing everything that we want from film criticism.
I think it's exciting that, as you said, it's going to be an evolving position, but also it's really telling to me, you were talking over our meal about the fact that BuzzFeed are hiring reporters, writers, they are running long-form stuff, and it's very intriguing in that, most of the time, the dream is that some stuff pays for everything, or rather the higher traffic stuff pays for the longer, more contemplative pieces that don't offer the dopamine rush of, in a magazine, what would be the front of book. But they still keep readers connected. The idea of it, BuzzFeed is spending the money that they've made off of becoming a viral sensation, whatever that means in this day and age, and we're spending in longer form stuff. That's deeply heartening.
It is, and it's something that was really exciting to me in applying for the position and in talking about it and in, getting it, is that they seem to have a genuine interest in spending time on pieces, as well as having the lists, as well as having the kind of quicker turnaround. A lot of their profiles involve talking to someone for an hour or more, talking to secondary sources, spending several, interviews over several days with someone in ways that you don't tend to see in internet-only writing.
Ways that you don't tend to see in a lot of print writing. I mean, the whole thing about the Anthony Lane slobber piece on Scarlett Johansson was my thinking, hombre, you probably could have called her up and gotten a few minutes on the phone.
You know,
you're not writing for Ain't It Cool. It's not like you have to look at this solely from the outside, but you're saying things like secondary sources and actual reporting. That's rather refreshing.
It is, and it's something that's been almost shocking to me, having come from several great online outlets, but where there's the expectation, I think, in almost everywhere, that turnaround is quick. Right, and that it's best to have many pieces over a day, that you can take a bit more time, that you can take several days to finish a piece, that you can work on a piece on the side for a while, is something I'm really excited about.
Our current model is, publish or perish, but you have to publish so fast that you may very well perish. A lot of people who work for a site on the sole desk or something, have to keep a lot of that stuff going, and you're not going to. Is that correct? I mean, you'll be filing stuff on a regular basis. You'll be covering stories as you need to, but there's not a thing of, we demand X number of posts per day, week, month.
No, there's not.
And thank God.
Thank God. There's also not an expectation to cover that, even within the entertainment group, that everything can be covered. The idea is that you write about things that are appealing to you, that are exciting to you as a writer. So I've been told that if I want to go back and write about the same film three times, you know, about different topics about it, that's fine. Which is something that I don't feel ever happens, you know.
And that's something I was talking with somebody about that actually via the Miracle Bon Mot machine of Twitter, how now and then as a writer you really, really, really want to get behind a film and push and do everything you can, but in a freelance world it's really tough to do that because you tend to write one thing and that's all somebody wants, if that, you know. But when you have a salaried gig, you have tremendous more opportunity and a great chance to explore.
Yeah, and that's something that it was something when I was talking to the editor who hired me came up a lot, is the idea that because of the way film marketing and screening and the, you know, film journalism has tended to work, the conversation happens up until a film opens and then we turn to the next thing.
Which is the greatest trick the devil ever pulled, was getting us more excited for the next movie than eager to talk about the ones we already have.
Exactly.
The promotion industrial complex loves it when we just sit there going, what's next? What's happening? Set photos? And to me, it's maddening.
Yeah, and that for most readers, the actual conversation that you can have about seeing a film is, if you're lucky, if it's a wide release film, you know, in that over the next week after it opens, and sometimes longer if it's a limited release film. You may not be able to see a film until weeks after those initial reviews have come out in New York and LA. So I think that the opportunity to revisit something that has already opened and to not have to consider it dead world,
right,
and not newsworthy is a great one.
It's also really interesting in that a lot of the time I feel like the pace of entertainment media is set by the entertainment media, in that last week everybody was busting out their Captain America the Winter Soldier reviews, and all I could think was, nobody in America is going to see this movie for another 10 days. Can we hold off a bit? The whole idea of being first. I'm a first on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm a first negative review on Rotten Tomatoes, which some people love to crow over. I'm going to take good over first, you know? Is that wrong? Am I not the audience here?
I do wonder if there's a bit of, you know, blindness in that we've created, where
right,
we only see everyone else's reviews and we only see the access that we have as journalists, which is not the access that most of our readers have.
Right. And to me, it's the whole thing of, like, you know, if I feel like I'm some kind of samurai cowboy talking from the inside of Hollywood, giving a straight shoot to people in the know, you can just kill me. I like writing for people who see movies and want to think about them. And that means everywhere. And now and then that's not on the time clock that we get inside this very small bubble. But at the same time, people who do that get really effective SEO. So it's easy to see why they do it, even if you can't understand precisely why they do it.
Yeah, though I wonder if there's not something to be said about the conversation that can be had once people have seen a film. You know, I covered television for IndieWire for 2 years before I took on this new position, and something that I thought was very interesting about the ever-growing television review industry is that you know, something airs on television, and after that, it's fair game with spoiler warnings to talk about everything that happens, you know? And that part of the problem when you have a conversation based only on the time before a film opens is that you can't really go into details about the actual developments in a film,
right,
because of all, people see that, you know, spoilers, you're ruining the movie for me. When does that conversation happen?
I don't know. I have this whole thesis that when I'm writing stuff up, and like you, I've been doing this for a while, and I've done it for a bunch of different people, and I've managed to not be too battered or bruised by changing house styles. But I have a general thesis that if it's in the trailer, you can talk about it, or also if you need to talk about it to truly discuss how bad the movie is. I felt it was impossible to talk about Million Dollar Baby without talking about what a lugubrious cheat it is. It pretty much, you know, hi, meet this character, and now we're going to kill her. You know, phony baloney circumstance that would never happen legally or morally.
Thanks for ruining the movie for me, Rocky.
First of all, and, you know, I didn't ruin it. Clint Eastwood did already. I mean, I don't like having to do that, but at the same time, it feels kind of disingenuous to say, this movie does not work dramatically or artistically, but I can't tell you why.
Yeah, and I think that people are, at least on the internet, people have become so sensitive about it that I find myself getting so loose with mentioning any plot details at all that I, you know, sometimes you feel like you're writing in the abstract.
Right. Just, Captain America faces a villain.
Yes.
I remember a great phone call I got early one morning. I had living out here in California, and I got a phone call, and somebody said, you have clearly not woken up yet. And I said, no, why not? And they said, because your name is the 32nd ranked search item on Google. And I had published a negative Transformers 2 review, which mentioned that Optimus Prime, in the course of a film, quote-unquote, dies and come back. I believe it was, oh, the truck dies, wah-wah, sad trombone, cue American flags, but he comes back. People were angry about being told that Optimus Prime died and came back, even though they would be angrier if he just died and didn't come back. And second of all, he dies and come back, so it seems like a bit of a zero-sum game to me, you know?
Yes.
Do you find that it's very problematic in that now and then it is nearly impossible to muster up any enthusiasm for something people clearly love?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
But I think that that's one of the benefits of, you know, now, and this was true about television as well, just because I was the only person writing about television on staff at IndieWire. I mean, there's a freedom to that as much as you can be, like, overwhelmed by how much is out there. But if something does not engage you at all, you can avoid writing about it. You know, there's still, I can understand the drive to be completist. The New York Times still reviews every movie.
Right.
But, you know, having worked as a freelancer and done a lot of freelance reviews, oftentimes that means you get handed a movie that's not that great. I mean, not that terrible either. There are a lot of films out there, but over 800 films got released in New York alone last year. And most of those films are not, you know, they're not noteworthy in any way.
But it's also to me the whole thing of, but especially in a terrain of bigger and bigger blockbusters, you know, the fact that you love the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes, there you go.
I'm not sure about, I'm old, Allison, I don't know. Are they Terrapins? But more importantly, when somebody says, ooh, I love those characters, I just think, great. Does that mean that you're going to be happy to see them on the big screen in any form?
Yeah, well, I think in that case you have nostalgia coming in as well.
Right.
Where a former coworker of mine was talking about how much he loved the original film, which I remember watching on VHS. We owned it. I don't remember anything about it except for just having the enjoyment that you have as a kid where you can watch anything over and over and over again because it doesn't...
Because it moves.
Yes,
and it has
moves,
colors and sounds.
And there are some jokes that, you know, you like.
And there are some that you pretend you get.
Exactly.
Because everyone else seems to be laughing.
Yeah. And I wonder if that same kind of feeling, that warm, fuzzy feeling of being a kid and being so, you know, easily moved by things, that guides you to be so forgiving of the same properties being recycled in multi-million dollar form.
I feel like a spoonful of nostalgia helps a lot of poison go down.
Yeah.
In that, you know, I joked that with the Gem movie, I was able to go directly from hating the baby boom for shoving unwanted film adaptations of existing material down my throat, directly to hating millennials for having unwanted adaptations of material they love jammed down my throat. I don't know what happened in my generation. I don't think we liked anything, nor do we have numbers or power on our side. But I just really felt like a switch got flipped, and it was like, you're going to go from hating the idea of rebooting My Mother to the Car and directly to the idea of hating somebody rebooting Pokemon. It's like my generation doesn't even get a chance to be horrible. What to you makes a movie great? I have a thesis about this, which I can certainly share, but what I'm wondering is, do you just look for the lightning rule? Do you look for the thing where you go, yeah, that's it? Or do you have a more thought-out philosophy?
I definitely do not have a more thought-out philosophy. Right. I don't think that's something I can qualify at all.
Right.
But, I mean, the films I love can be so different, you know? I love some entirely, you know, like, glacial art house films.
Yes.
I've loved some incredibly dumb comedies. I've loved big, splashy action movies. I've loved, you know, too quirky indies.
Right.
I don't know that there's a particular quality that I would say they all have in common, other than that they appealed to me. But what is your theory, please?
I don't even know if it's a theory. It's more of a sort of idea. But it's sort of... Well, the way it goes is this. I ask myself, you know, there are five questions you can ask about any movie. Is it well directed? Is it well performed? Is it well written? Is it well executed? And is it actually about something? I don't mean, I don't mean huge moral meaning. Blazing Saddles is about being funny, and it does that extraordinarily well. And if I can get a yes on all five of those, I feel like I'm watching a pretty good movie. But the sixth one, the final question is, for me, could this story be told as well in any other medium, or is it taking advantage of a unique nature of cinema to do so? You know, film for me is not a slower opera, or a less bouncy musical, or a brighter comic book, or longer TV. The two best things I saw at Sundance this year were Richard Linklater's Boyhood, because that took advantage of film in a really unique way. And you can imagine the novel of it, but in many ways that would be an inferior experience, because it would just be all this churning first person of like, and then I walk down the yard. But in film, we're on the outside of it, and it's as opaque to us as it in many ways is to a protagonist. And I really like that. You couldn't tell it any other way. I also saw Eskil Vogt's Blind. He was a guy who co-wrote Reprise with Joachim Trier, which is a movie I love.
Fantastic movie.
And he picked up a bunch, and it's about this woman in Norway who has gone blind and is starting to question the things her husband tells her about the physical universe. And so much of it is editing and cutting and memory and imagination expressed in cinema. There's a scene where two of the characters run into each other at a cafe having a cup of tea, or was it on the metro? I can't recall. But now and then they're sitting on the metro holding their cups of tea, looking slightly confused, as if to say, well, were we here? It's utterly cinematic, and that, I think, is for me, what makes a really, really great movie is it can't exist in any other format. And in terms of execution, I don't know, I feel like we're living in an age where a lot of people are confusing expense with quality.
Yeah. But the thing is, we're also living in an age where anything can look a base level of good that it never used to be able to.
Right.
You know, for relatively little money.
That's the whole thing Neil Gaiman said about Robert Zemeckis. When Neil Gaiman was writing up Beowulf, Robert Zemeckis said, what do you really want to put in here? And Neil Gaiman said, I want this one sequence, I imagine, but it would take too much to shoot. And Robert Zemeckis shrugged and said cavalierly, I can put pretty much anything on film for about $1 million a minute, so go for it. And part of me thinks that's horrible, because Robert Zemeckis is the last person to judge what can or can't look good on screen and work in a story.
Right.
But it is interesting to live in that age of liberation.
Sure.
At the same time, the problem is that, you know, so much of his stuff looks the same.
Yes.
If you squint while watching Noah, you could be watching a Lord of the Rings orc attack sequence. You
Absolutely.
Could be watching the Battle of Blackwater from Game of Thrones.
Sure.
We have this... Our vocabulary is being made up of more and more reductible pieces that are cheaper and easier to do thanks to advances in effects, mm-hmm. but which are getting used in the same way thanks to a lack of advance in narratology.
Sure. I think you also see on the lower budget end that you can buy a really nice camera now for
yes.
for not that much money, and it's certainly a huge improvement over what a lot of independent films used to look like. But I think that you have this certain quality then where you can say, well, this film is beautifully shot. It's still the same, you know, lousy romance, like kind of like indie romance that I've seen,
right.
you know, at this festival every year. But it looks
Maybe
really nice
Maybe these two are going to go on a road trip.
Exactly.
Yeah, when I was talking last week with Tom and Matt Berninger of Mistaken for Strangers, the director explained that, Tom explained that his camera essentially looked like a burger. He could put it in his hands and hold it like a burger. He could put it on a lanyard and put it around his neck. And when the time came to use a picture of him shooting for the poster, they had to Photoshop out the camera he actually used and put in his hand something larger that would read like an actual quote-unquote camera.
Yeah.
And that I really, really dug as an idea that, like, you know, you can have an inobtrusive, affordable level of construct at the same time. It kind of depends what story you're telling.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't know, the whole idea of how accessible a nice camera is, a relatively nice camera is, and how accessible just a functional camera is something that I have like very mixed feelings about. Because on one end, it's increasingly opening up the world of film to people who, you know, might not have a lot of money to make a film. And on the other hand, it's opening up the world of film to people.
A lot of people who don't necessarily have the skills to make a truly compelling film.
Exactly.
There's an interesting thing I'm finding with documentaries a lot these days, which is where I sit and I go, this is a really intriguing story. It's kind of too bad you got to it first.
Yeah.
And that I think, I would love to see a better structured, better shot, better told version. Did you see Valentine Road?
I did.
I did not dig that film.
I did not either. I felt like it actually...
This was an HBO documentary.
Yes.
It played at Sundance. It was about a school shooting in Oxnard where a male student who would wear dresses and make comments said to an older boy, "I want to be your Valentine." That older boy brought a gun to school and shot him in the head twice in full view of everyone.
Yes.
And this is a tragic story, but at the same time, every rational question I had watching that story was never answered.
Agreed. And I felt like because it was such a... In a lot of ways, it was a story about, like, two kids from lousy homes who
right.
had terrible upbringings. And there was just a general sense of tragedy about it to that.
Yeah.
I felt like... Yeah. There were so many questions in the lead-up that I wanted answered.
Well, the only thing that can make a tragedy worse is to not learn from it.
Yes.
And so when they talk about things in Valentine Road, like, oh, the young man had signed a co-agreed-upon disciplinary agreement of conduct. Really? That would be intriguing. When did that happen? Why did that happen?
Yeah.
The young man who performed a shooting, how does he get a gun out of a home fraught with ex-cons, any which of whom... the ownership of a gun would be a reason to violate parole.
Yeah.
All that stuff I never got.
Yeah.
And it made me really go, I wish somebody else had gotten to this story.
Yeah. I think the other thing with that film is that it was so determined to make a martyr out of
the young man
who was shot that it didn't actually register the complexity of him as a person in
right.
a way that... You know, the Macklemore song plays several times over when this happened.
Yes.
But, you know, he was much more complicated a person than that, you know? And I think that, like, and wasn't kind of just someone who... He was someone who kind of was confrontational in a way that I thought was really interesting, you know? And I kind of wish that had been addressed more.
Well, I mean, I was a confrontational kid in grade school.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Canada in the 70s, I merely got the crap beaten out of me.
Right.
Which very much added to my character now. But, I mean, at a certain point, though, the whole question of, oh, this young man's conduct had been talked about, so let's not talk about it. Again, with the intention on, we have a through line already, mm-hmm. let's just shoot it and film it.
Yeah.
So the you know, Ted Hope, who always talks about the age of abundance, has a question of this. Has the age of abundance lowered the bar, which I always, you know, call the Ramones problem, which is that anyone can be the Ramones, but not necessarily anyone should.
Yeah. Certainly, I watch films all the time where I want to ask the filmmaker, or not as much anymore, but 2 years ago, when I watched the most new releases I had ever in my career as a film and TV journalist, I watched a lot of those mid-level indies, and I always wanted to ask filmmakers, like, who do you think is watching this film? You know, this is true for documentaries, this is true for a lot of other indies as well, where I just wanted to say, like, what does this film do differently? Or if it's a documentary, why would someone want to invest, say, 2 hours on this topic? It's dear to you.
Right.
Understandably, you invested your time and money. It's not easy to make a documentary, certainly not easy to even break even on a documentary. But why would anyone else watch it? You know, because I feel like that's a question a lot of those films, especially in an age where there's so much competition, there's so much talk about television, rival, you know, like bringing audiences away in terms of like the conversation that we have.
I think we still have books too.
Books, I've heard they still exist. Yes. But you know, that
there's a whole strata of films that seems to exist for no other reason than to keep Ron Perlman fed.
Right.
And I'm not sure what those films are doing other than that.
Yeah. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating to watch one of them and just say, like, there's a lot of effort and sweat and tears and blood that went into this. And I don't know why, if you never gave any thought to why someone would want to watch it.
Oh. Well, I mean, that's another problem I have with a lot of film criticism these days, is the question of who's reading this, you or another guy just like you who's working on their own version of it? Is this for people to read, or is it for people to be impressed by how clever you are? I was reading a review of At World's End, which used the phrase res crudescence early on, and I thought, I hope I'm not really stupid, but I have no clue what that word means. And I'm wondering why an editor didn't go, remove, or what?
No.
It just feels like there's a certain kind of film criticism happening these days, which is all about, basically, I'm going to write for 5 people and everyone else can go stuff it.
Yeah. One of the things that was very helpful to me as a writer was coming up through some magazines that had very, at these days, like outrageously old-fashioned structures in terms of having multiple editors, a copy editor and a fact-checker, and I worked for a while with one of the higher editors. So after a piece had already gone through copy editing, had gone through fact-checking, had gone through a round of edits, at least one, if not two, and I remember listening to him on the phone once with a writer talking through sentence by sentence and saying, like, you say this here, like, what does that mean? And just kind of demanding that. And, I don't think that anyone has the resources, or very few outlets have the resources for that level of, that rigor of editing. And I don't know that it's necessarily always a good thing. I think it tends to create a certain sameness in text, but to kind of demand that of a writer is... there's something kind of great about that, to be, well, like, justify your use of that word. Like, why that word?
There's something between The New Yorker and nothing.
Yes.
There's something between The New Yorker and click, I published. But more and more there isn't.
Yeah.
And you gotta do that stuff yourself. I could not tell you how many times my morning begins with, I'm terribly sorry, honey, but I wrote this, and the best way to hear if it makes sense is for me to read it out loud to somebody else, and I'm afraid since the cat can't speak, that's you. And I don't want to bother the neighbors, mm-hmm. nor the FedEx guy here. But I do find that in terms of an invaluable tool, reading stuff out loud is actually immensely valuable. If only for running it through a different center of your brain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely in the very basic sense of just copy editing your own work.
Right.
The only way I can do it. Because
right.
That's the only way you notice flubs in grammar or certain words missing.
Because you look at it and it's like, symbol, I wrote that question mark.
Yes.
And it's fine, genius.
Yeah, your eye just kind of skips over all of it. When you actually read it out loud, you have to grapple with it on a sentence-by-sentence basis, and it sounds very different.
And it also raises the whole question of, you know, you don't have to write in conversational English, but writing should be conversational.
Right. Exactly.
And any time you go kabah over a sentence or a word or a clause or a conjunction of clauses, that's never a good thing. But bear in mind, like, I was going to get George Orwell and Joan Didion tattooed on my arms at one point, and I'm not sure if that's a model these days. Is that a model these days? I'm not sure if it is. We are, of course, talking with Allison Wilmore, newly hired as the film critic at BuzzFeed.com, the popular clearinghouse of information and entertainment. Now, of course, you got to see Captain America: Winter Soldier this week.
I did.
Shall we talk about that briefly, just for, as the young people say, funsies?
Please.
This is the second film. It's all part of the Marvel film.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe, the MCU.
Again, I just like the phrase Marvel Cinematic Universe, because really, I'm not sure how many of these movies are cinematic.
It also includes the television series.
Oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, so it's not entirely fair in that regard either.
So the Marvel web of leveraged interconnected intellectual properties they didn't sell to other people being a bit unwieldy. But I guess the question is, did you enjoy Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and if so, why?
I enjoyed it a lot. I think it was actually my favorite of the non-supergroup Marvel films to have come out so far. And I enjoyed it in part because it was not filled with a lot of superpowers.
There's nobody in this shooting a laser beam out of their forehead.
Right.
People punch and shoot and kick. And do so well.
Yes. Very spectacularly in certain sequences.
Right. But, I mean, the model for this is not Wagner's Ring Cycle, but, like, The Raid.
Yes.
It's all up-close fight sequences and dirty deeds done lightning fast.
Yeah. And it also, it rather than deal with, a particular outsized villain who comes in, you know, with a electric whips or all of, whatever the kids are using these days, it deals with basically doubts about the greater good and an institution.
Right.
It's I know the filmmakers have cited 70s paranoid conspiracy thrillers as their...
Yeah, so that Captain America 2 is supposed to be 3 days of a falcon instead of 3 days of a condor.
Exactly.
Yes, the para-arms view, not the parallax view.
I mean, I think that the comparison's a little... It's still a superhero movie.
Well, no, it's
movie.
Like comparing a Big Mac to it. It's like comparing a burger to a steak.
Right.
They're different cuts, and one can be... And you can still have a well-made burger, but no one's going to confuse A with B.
Right. But I do feel... It does feel very different from the other films in that way. And I think that it makes Captain America, who's someone in the first film I found a little boring as a character, just because he is so straightforward.
Right.
You get it all there, right? He's patriotic.
But he wants to serve. He's patriotic. He's got a decent heart.
Exactly.
He becomes a superhuman, but the only one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go, Captain. You know, to drop him into the present day and have him grapple with everyone he knows being gone or about to die, to have him deal with
not knowing about Marvin Gaye and Star Wars.
Nirvana.
Yes.
Band.
Yes.
In brackets.
Rocky 2.
Yes.
I do like how that list is different in every country.
I thought that was a really nice touch.
It's a very clever touch.
Yeah.
I wonder what the Canadian one would. Anyhow. No.
Yeah.
all kidding. We all know it. Yeah. And like you said, that idea of melancholy in it a little bit. I was saying to you that I very much enjoy Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and would consider it my top third of Marvel films. I would put it up there with the first Iron Man. I am not the biggest fan of the Avengers. I find that the Avengers is a lot of wish fulfillment wrapped around very little movie and very familiar bricks held together by thin slices of Joss Whedon-y mortar.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like this worked. The only thing is it felt under-emoted, in that lots of things happen, but I don't really feel them, in that, you know, oh, this one character is a cyborg killer who gets frozen between assignments and wakes up confused and cold to kill yet again before going back to his icy sleep. Great. I wanted to feel that. I didn't want to just see it. I wanted to feel that. I wanted to get something of the out of that character more than 8 to 10 lines and 8 to 10 grunts.
Yeah, but I can see that. But I did feel that that the captain himself and Chris Evans like sold this really well, this idea of just being very dutiful and at the same time being very isolated and alienated and having serious doubts about your role in this contemporary world.
Right.
And I think that he did make that work in terms of, you know, it's a strange, I mean, like, I want the emotional truth behind this insane, you know, scenario.
Right.
But as close as you can get to that, I feel like he really sells it and makes the character a plausibly tragic figure.
And the other great thing is that the character plays like Jimmy Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no doubt in battle and total apprehension and hesitation anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I really dig that. There's a great photo. The L.A. Natural History Museum right now has this great exhibit called Becoming L.A. And it's a historical and cultural study of a county going from, you know, indigenous peoples to being part of Mexico to the present day. And they have this great photo of Jimmy Stewart getting inducted into the Army. And they don't do the whole... Do you know the whole story of Jimmy Stewart joining the Army?
No.
He finished whatever film he was working on when Pearl Harbor happened, which I think was a Philadelphia story. And basically immediately went down to the recruiting station. And they told him, I'm sorry, Mr. Stewart, but you're 6'4" and 137 pounds. You're underweight.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, but I want to serve. I've got my pilot's license already. I can serve. And they said, you're underweight. And he went back to whatever studio he was with. And they were ecstatic. And they were like, you can do a lot. You can make movies. You can sell bonds. And what Jimmy Stewart did without telling anyone was ate for 3 days. And not eliminating any of that new mass, and then went back in and barely squeaked over the weight limit to be 4F and wound up flying in command of 256 plane bomber wings in a European theater.
Yeah.
Which is a story I love because he then came back and did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And said nothing about it. You know, he occasionally did stuff for your Air Force Reserve. He wound up, you know, doing a lot of things for them. But it wasn't a big deal. It was just, this is what you're expected to do if you're me in this circumstance. And I really like that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the degree to which they bring that kind of Americanism to Captain America, while also bringing the idea of, you know, America was founded by asking some pretty good questions.
Yeah. And, you know, other characters in the Avengers have this, they're larger than life, they've got a lot of swagger.
Right.
They've got a bit of a smirk to them.
Right.
And that's not the case at all with Captain America. You know, there's very little sense of that self-congratulatory air that makes Iron Man very likable.
Right.
You know, that he kind of is the opposite of that.
A lot of the other heroes in that set are either aspirational, i.e. I wanted this to happen, or tragic. This happened to me and I can't do anything about it. And Captain America is just a guy with a job, which puts him much more in the John McClane continuum than it does alongside somebody like Tony Stark.
Yeah.
And I think we can both concur, Anthony Mackie with a jetpack exoskeleton is pretty awesome.
He's great. He really makes the case that someday he should have his own movie, you know? His own big movie.
Well, I mean, the question is, like, are we going to get movies for all of these characters?
I think if they could do it, they would. It should be said, you know, ScarJo is great as Black Widow. I did really like that she was, you know, the secondary character in this film. She plays a pretty big role.
It's interesting because you call this a solo Marvel joint, but there are plenty of people dropping in to lay down some bass riffs and, you know, play on a track or what have you.
Yeah. Well, but that I really liked the relationship she had with the captain, you know,
Yeah. Which
is just not, does not fall into any of the conventional ones that
Right. Having
a man and woman character paired up normally do.
It's cautious, friendly co-workership.
Yes.
And I really dig that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, again, there's very little violin music playing in Captain America the Winter Soldier. Also, the Russo brothers have a great eye for action. They hire the right people. And with a lot of good character storytelling and fight scene stuff, I think that as Nick Fury's car is blown up and the Winter Soldier, again, talking about these plots, because the IQ feels like it's dropping, but he does this nifty little matador turn out of a Plaza del Toro. It's like, I know I have to get out of the way because I caused this. I know exactly how little I have to try and get out of the way.
Yeah.
And it looks very, very cool.
Yeah. And just having to actually have, like, rely on physicality, on, like, people fighting, you know, on space actually being, you know, being laid out.
Right.
Makes for a lot of scenes that are much more satisfying than the usual, the sameness that you tend to get with a lot
pointing
of...
pointing and then matting in the light beam later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you get so used to seeing these things that used to be impossible to put on screen that they just, you don't even register them anymore. And there's something just to be said about, like, choreography.
Yeah.
And actually really showing good, bodies.
Really good fight choreography in this. Yeah. And Mr. Evans has proven himself remarkably adept at it.
Yeah.
You know? He's in this a lot doing the stuff. And I know they have a great stunt team, and I know they do amazing things with computers, but he works hard to sell it.
Yeah,
he works really hard to sell it. Again, Chris Evans, 3-pitcher contact. Sebastian Stan, 9-pitcher contract. I was saying to somebody, is Marvel pretty much the closest thing we have to the old school studio system?
I've had the exact same conversation with someone else.
I was specifically looking at all of the technical people in Cap 2 who are repeats. Like, so-and-so worked on Thor, so-and-so worked on Iron Man. A lot of the production design, a lot of the costume design, which is good because they've clearly known how to pull it off. But I thought, this is really the closest thing we have to the old school studio system, right?
Well, and I think that, you know, if Marvel were to have their way, that would be exactly how it would work. You'd have someone on salary, you know?
Yeah.
Because you don't, if you really want to have something be this cross-platform project, right?
A multi-tentacled octopus.
Right. You know, you see them, as someone who keeps watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., despite how disappointing I find it.
Right.
It's interesting to see how they would just, like, all they want is to have these characters come through, and I would actually probably accommodate it perfectly well, and it would be such a better story, but that
Chris Evans has better things to do than drop by a show run by the brother of a guy who made his movie.
Exactly. And they have, so they have a few secondary characters, you know, on occasion come through, but that, it would make total sense.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is one of those shows where I watch Twitter chat about it, and I think, you do know that your hating still equals ratings. Like, even if you're watching it to be disappointed, somebody's going, well, they're watching. You know, or I always say that, you know, money you spend at the box office out of disgust, you know, still goes into a bank account just as well for the studio.
Exactly. It doesn't have a different flavor.
Right. And, oh, I can't buy a fancy car with this. This is just for ugly things. Chloe, what do you think is the number one thing Marvel could do better? And, you know, a lot of people think they're doing a jolly good job, and you can certainly disagree with that in bits and pieces, but what do you as the number one thing Marvel could be doing better?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I mean, I have my answer.
Yeah.
It says about this stuff.
I mean, I find the idea of what they're trying to do in terms of the cinematic universe, to use the term that you hate, I do find
dislike.
I do find the idea of it as basically a transmedia project very interesting, because I don't know when a corporation has shown the kind of nerdy attention to detail that has been required.
Something referenced in the movie will be referenced on the TV show, will be later be referenced in the Facebook game, and glad are we all to live in this age of synergy.
Exactly. And I think there's something very new, slightly terrifying about it, but I find it very interesting as well. I suppose what I want to see from it, as not being a particularly rabid fan of superheroes, I want to see, like, weird downtime things. I want to
see... Well, you and I were talking over our meal that if the Avengers had a 20-minute... Avengers 2 had a 20-minute long section of everyone bitching about the 401k.
Yeah.
I would love that. You know,
yeah.
I think you're saying right, like downtime.
Well, I mean, you know, when the cutscene that Avengers ends on, in which they're sitting silently in a shawarma restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of, like, what non-saving the world time. The world can't always be saved, and yet every single one of these movies involves the world being saved, right? The world is constantly in danger from all of these forces. To see something in which that wasn't the case, I think would be fascinating.
There are two things I'd like to see Marvel do, and I think that Marvel could do, needs to do better. One is just representation. So much of this stuff is, the version that comes to screen is a version that was thought up in the 60s by Stan Lee, possibly when he was drunk on his lunch break. So, you know, the idea of representation is, you know, we're a diverse group. We have a hot redhead. I'd love to see more active work being done on that in terms of casting and writing. And the other thing is, up the bad guys, in that I want to see good actors recurring, much in the same way that the heroes do, in a way. Like, you and I were talking about the Bosch pilot from Amazon and Titus Welliver. And every time I see Titus Welliver, I think, there is a guy I would buy with a lightning whip or a laser glove or, you know, pronouncing, the world will bow before me, blank.
Yeah.
There is a guy who could pull that off. Find those people and, like, have them, you know, work in the universe as well. I always feel like things are only as good as their nemesis.
Yeah.
And that right now the MCU has a pretty real nemesis problem.
Yeah, well, I feel like the problem is that they always come in and want to do things like take over the world or destroy the world. It's one of the things that I liked about the new Captain America is that there is an actual, you know, ideology behind what the bad guys want to do.
As Gabe Toro said, it's torn from the headlines if your newspapers are all from 2002.
Right. But it's an actual plan. It's not, I want to be king of the universe, or I want to destroy everything because ... You know, or because I'm evil.
Right.
I mean, to actually be like, I think I'm doing something that's for the functional greater good.
And the Marvel comics have a great tradition of that. These reluctant dictators who will regrettably take up a yoke of the oppressor. If only that kind of stuff I want more of.
Yeah.
I want more of that. I want better writing in terms of representation and better writing in terms of nemesis.
Yes, I think that's fair. That's fair to ask.
You know, but at the same time, they're making a lot of money.
That's true.
I mean, do you think we're sitting around going, we don't have to change a damn thing?
I don't know. It's funny. I think about the Fast and the Furious franchise a lot.
Right.
And how that went from being about the late Paul Walker and the ethnically ambiguous Vin Diesel.
Right.
To becoming the most diverse cast that, you know, ensemble cast I can really think of in terms of, like, mainstream film.
Action film or any other kind of
film. Film. And every time those did well in the box office, they would report about how it's astonishing, like, people of color are coming out to see these movies, as if it were a surprise that people want to see
people
themselves or someone who doesn't just look, you know, like the average
Protestant.
Yes.
Yeah.
On screen. You know, I think that people know Hollywood is slowly starting to adapt to this fact that, like, the country changed a long time ago.
Well, I know. Whenever I picture studios moving, I just picture somebody trailing their hand behind an aircraft carrier, going, now if I turn my hand like this, eventually it'll turn the other way. There's so much inertia to overcome.
So I've listened to and talked to Robert Rodriguez several times over the past few months because he launched a new TV network. And he talks about race in a really interesting way. And he told a story about Spy Kids and how when he was pitching it to the Weinsteins, he had wrote the family as Hispanic, which they are in the film. And the Weinstein said, well, you know, I don't really understand. I mean, isn't this movie for everyone? Like, why are they Hispanic? And he had to figure out a way to counter that. And ultimately he said, you know, you don't have to be British to watch James Bond. And they said, okay, fine. And Spy Kids, you know.
That is such a brilliant argument that I feel bad the only thing we got out of it was Spy Kids, right?
I know.
Like, why couldn't you have saved that for something better?
Really? Yeah, I know. But it was something that I feel like that's the mindset that's had. You're like, obviously, a white lead is neutral. Everyone else can only appeal to a niche.
Right. I had a conversation once with Dwayne Johnson, and it was a whole thing.
Who I
unabashedly am fond of.
Yes.
But one thing about him is that, like, in terms of human beings at that level of Hollywood whom you can talk to, he's a crazy smart man. And I said to him, you know, there's a list of stars, you know, Tom Cruise, Leonardo DiCaprio, Johnny Depp, Will Smith used to be in it, who have never taken the spandex money. You've never played a superhero and you've never taken the spandex money. Why is that? And he said that he liked the phrase spandex money, and he probably didn't, but he's a charmer and made my heart go pitter-patter. But he also gave this really interesting answer about saying, you know, these characters are tough because fans love them and these characters are iconic, and fans want these characters to resemble what they know and also move them forward. And so it's very, very problematic. We're trying to find the right thing. And I said, what we really need is a time machine, and Stan Lee has to invent a Polynesian superhero in the 60s. And he laughed, and he said, yeah. And then we moved away from the topic. But I thought, that's kind of sad, in that a great actor is kind of being kept out of this bubble of the culture. Because...
Oh, look at the Fantastic Four casting.
Right.
You know, there are people who have this idea about what these characters look like, and there's no flexibility on that.
Right.
You know? They look a certain way.
My bigger problem with the Fantastic Four isn't the idea that Johnny Storm is black, but rather that these are the same people who screwed it up twice the last time. I don't feel especially great about them taking another kick at the cat just to keep the copyright.
Yeah.
This is also one of those Sony Amazing Spider-Man deals, where if they weren't making a movie, they would lose it.
Yeah.
And God forbid that should happen. We've been talking with Allison Wilmore, a film critic at BuzzFeed, who's out here in Los Angeles for a few days. But you're going to be working mostly from New York.
Are
you enjoying that? You're a New Yorker. I mean, you grew up in San Francisco, but you've been living in New York for so long, and you love it.
I like it.
Yeah.
I feel like I go back and forth on it, especially after as long a winter as we've just had. I'm not sure what I'm doing in California, but... Sure, it's a great place, and there's access to a lot of amazing things, especially in terms of film.
But while you were here in Los Angeles, we ate at Golden State on Fairfax Avenue, located very near Cantor's Deli. It's a burger place of some note. What did you have, and did you enjoy it?
I had their classic burger. It was delicious, yes, and some french fries, because you gotta have french fries every once in a while.
And they delivered a side of mayo.
Yes, I like the mayo and french fries. I have terrible, you know, pretenses towards being European, apparently. Or I'm just disgusting.
Now and then, when I have fries, I will ask if people have malt vinegar, just coming out of a Canadian-British tradition of ketchup. No, vinegar. But they never do. But Golden State, I had a turkey burger, which is jolly good. Comes with provolone, which is a nice choice in terms of overall flavor. A really good brioche bun. They also serve gelato from Scoops there, and their jalapeno slaw is really deftly done. What's the best place to get a burger in New York? Is it Shake Shack?
Shake Shack is good. I like the burger at Peter Luger, the famous/infamous steakhouse in Williamsburg that's been around for decades.
Right.
It's where you will find an $80 porterhouse for two if you manage to make reservations, which you have to do months in advance, and the waiters are famously ill-tempered and sneer at you. But if you go for lunch only, there's a burger available. I think it costs like $12, and you can get fries for extra. And it's made up of like ends of the steak, and it is exquisite. It's just a burger, bun, and a slab of onion.
That actually sounds really impressive.
Very good.
Allison, of course, can be found at BuzzFeed.com, where you will find her reviews starting this very week. But you can also find her at Allison Wilmore, AllisonWillmore on Twitter. She's also the co-host of the superb Film Spotting SVU podcast, along with Matt Singer, which recommends great streaming movies, which is strongly recommended to any fan of The Lunch. Allison, thank you very kindly for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You've been listening to The Lunch Podcast. You can find it on Twitter, at The Lunch Podcast. I'm your regular host, James Rocky. Thank you so very kindly for listening. And until next time, go to the movies with your friends. Have a meal afterwards. Talk about it. It's a good thing. We'll be right back.
Jesus.